They say that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. What do reciprocity, annexation, commercial union, harmonization, free trade, NAFTA, and now the SPP have in common?
Nothing!
They're all about a corporate takeover of economies and sovereignty. They are all to bring us to the point that we are today. For those of us who are awake, the Security and Prosperity Partnership is part of a bigger plan that has been in the works for a very, very long time and involves the sovereignty of all the nations of the world. In our case, it's a pretext that is leading us into a North American Union, much like the European Union, where countries exist, but laws are made somewhere else. Standards are harmonized, or in our case, lowered. Health freedoms are quashed. Civil liberties are curbed, all under the name of security. But most importantly, the most important aspect of a nation's sovereignty, its currency, disappears and is replaced by a new common currency. This plan has been moving forward at the speed of a runaway train since September 11, 2001. In fact, it was probably a big topic of discussion at this year's Bilderberg Conference in Virginia. There were invitees from 44 nations plus the European Union present. Know who attended from Canada and US? John Adams, Associate Deputy Minister of National Defense. Ian Brody, Chief of Staff in the Prime Minister's Office. Isn't that special? Edmund Clark from the TD Bank Financial Group. Paul Desmarais from Power Corporation. He's a regular. Murray Edwards from Canadian Natural Resources Limited. Wonder what they want from him. Roger Martin from the Rotman School of Management of the U of T. Frank McKenna. He moves around a lot, but now he's with the TD Bank Financial Group. Richard Pritchard from the Toronto Star. Heather Reisman from Indigo Books and Music. They like her a lot. She's a regular as well. But by the way, we should all be boycotting Indigo because of their support on Israeli apartheid. Some of the 44 U.S. invitees were Keith Alexander from the National Security Agency, Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve System, which is neither a system nor has it a reserve. Timothy Geithner from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, ditto. Paul Gigault from the Wall Street Journal. Donald Graham from the Washington Post. They're the folks that Rockefeller thanked in 1991 for their silence. Richard Holbrooke, Frank Pearl, and James Johnson from Perseus Merchant Bank and Private Equity Holdings, LLC. James, by the way, is tasked with finding Obama's running mate. Kenneth Jacobs and Vernon Jordan from the LaSalle Brothers Banking System. Henry Kissinger, another regular. Jessica Matthews from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a global think tank, a Rockefeller Foundation. Henry Paulson Jr. from the Secretary of the Treasury. Richard Pearl, he's one of those fine folks that brought us the Project for a New American Century, calling for a new Pearl Harbor. Condoleezza Rice, David Rockefeller, of course, and two former chairmen of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn and Paul Wolfowitz. Boy, would I have liked to have been a fly on the wall at this meeting. But citizens like you and me aren't allowed to know what they talk about. And that tells me we should all be very suspicious. You know, Canada has been going seriously downhill in the last 34 years. But few people know why. In 1938, our Prime Minister, William Lyon Mackenzie King, took a private central bank and nationalized it. It was called the Bank of Canada. It is called the Bank of Canada. It became the People's Bank, and governments at all levels used Bank of Canada loans at near zero interest to fund all manner of infrastructure and social programs. Tommy Douglas knew it, and that's how we got universal health care. It's also how we got out of the Depression, paid for our involvement in World War II, got our Canada Pension Plan, built schools, hospitals, housing, Canada's great highways, airports, seaways, and more. For 41 years, Canada grew and prospered, all while remaining sovereign. But all that changed in 1974. Funnily enough, around the same time, we became a member of the G7 and embraced the principles of globalization. In 1974, our government stopped using our publicly owned Bank of Canada for more than about 2% of the money in circulation. It began to do what you and I do when we need money. It started borrowing from private banks. Now, have you ever heard of anything more ridiculous than that? Talk about regressing. So you may wonder, what has this to do with why we're here today? Well, it has everything to do with it. A very long time ago, the banker Mayor Rothschild said, "Give me control of a nation's money, and I care not who makes her laws." He said that because he knew that those who control the money also control the lawmakers. Our government gave away sovereignty on our money, and that opened the floodgates to what has been happening since. Although Canada has always traded, you can literally track the progression of the dismantling of Canada since the mid-70s. Contrary to what you may think, the Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, CAFTA, Atlantica, Pacifica, Cascadia, Tilma, and the SPP are not about free trade. They are financial agreements that have allowed the corporate takeover of nations. What has happened in the last 34 years by traitorous politicians, too numerous to mention, from all political stripes, should make all Canadians hang their heads in shame. Shame for not knowing our own history. Shame for not holding our governments accountable. Shame for being too comfortable, too complacent, too dumbed down. Shame on us for electing traitors whose allegiance is not to countries but to corporations at the bottom line.
Welcome back to another edition of the Toronto Change Radio Show. Thanks for tuning in. You just heard an audio clip of a speech given by Wendy Forrest of the Canadian Action Party speaking outside the Parliament building in Toronto, the Queen's Park, at the Rally to Save Canada, talking about the Bank of Canada, the Security Prosperity Partnership Agreement, and the Bilderberg Group, who were the Canadian business CEOs and political leaders in attendance at the Bilderberg Conference happened this June in Chantilly, Virginia. She asks, what are our political leaders discussing in this secretive meeting? Could it be the annexation of Canadian natural resources or possibly the harmonization of Canadian, U.S., and Mexican military forces? The Canadian Action Party has done a terrific job over the years of exposing the North American Union, and the Rally to Save Canada held in Toronto this June was the sequel to the February 16th nationwide rally to save Canada to stop the SPP, and in February, nationwide in many of the major cities across Canada, the Canadian Action Party coordinated with the local with local organizers in each city to have a protest on the same day in each major city across Canada, and they're keeping the momentum going. Online, just check out CanadianActionParty.ca for more information, and here at Toronto Change, we'll be following this as well. What I want to do on today's show is say to you that this is your radio show, the Toronto Change Radio Show. It is available for everybody to participate in, and I would invite you to write to me at my email. It is info.to911truth@gmail.com. So info with a period and TO for Toronto, 911truth@gmail.com. And write to me with feedback on the show. Maybe you've got some suggestions for what type of topics we could go into. But specifically, if you've got something to say, step up to the mic, so to speak. Let's say your comments air on the show. Send me an email with a copy of your MP3 files, or maybe you can do what I do and post files up to archive.org, which in my finding has been the best website to offer unlimited file hosting. So you can just log on to archive.org, download the CC Publisher, which is a basic FTP setup, so it'll speed up the upload time, and then email me with the links to the audio files. I promise to get back to you and incorporate into the show, and that's what we're going to do on today's show. I have some interviews done by the man, the legend, Black Krishna, who has been host of the CKLN radio show, Rude Awakening, which you can find archives of his show on archive.org too. Just run a search for Black Krishna, you'll find a history of his shows, and he's currently not hosting that show, but he's keeping up the tradition, and he's emailed me some interviews done. The first one that you'll hear is an interview with him and Dan Dix, the coordinator of the June 14th rally to Save Canada, and they're going to be talking about occultive influences in mainstream rock and roll. So we'll get straight to that and come back with a little bit more after that.
July 14, 2008, we're speaking with Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca. Mr. Dix, tell us a bit about the OTO, Aleister Crowley, and the Masonic influence on music.
All right, the OTO is the Order Templi Orientis. Crowley did not start it. He was invited into the OTO, I can't remember the year, but it was after he got back from learning about Eastern mysticism and the practices of, yoga and all the spiritualism that he got into over there. So he essentially rewrote the rites of the OTO. And then, yeah, from there, he obviously his most famous work is a book called The Book of the Lost, mm-hmm. Which he apparently he wrote it in 3 days from a spirit that he says he got in contact with when he was visiting Egypt, and I believe it was the spirit of Horus is what he told him it was, and he dictated this book to him, in which the main commandment in the book is, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. So it turns out that you mentioned music, the whole rock and roll industry and that whole thing that exploded in the 60s, they were all into Crowley. They loved Aleister Crowley. Yeah, the Beatles, you know, Sgt. Pepper, they got Crowley's picture on the cover. There's the Doors album where there's a picture of Jim Morrison sitting in front of a busk of Aleister Crowley. Jimmy Page actually bought Aleister Crowley's house and currently resides there. Actually, Crowley's house that he bought used to be a church that burned down, killing everyone inside.
Where it is, Loch Ness.
Oh, right, that's that Loch Ness is where it's located.
No way.
So, I mean, you know, his influence runs rampant.
Black Sabbath, Mr. Crowley.
Absolutely, you know, Black Sabbath, they love this stuff, you know, because, hey, do what thou wilt sounds good, doesn't it? It's like, hey, what, I can do whatever I want and there's no consequence for nothing? That sounds good to me. So, of course, the rock and roll world, they love that, you know. And Crowley, he actually had a huge influence on the big drug guru of the 60s.
Ginsberg? Oh, Timothy Leary.
That's it. Yes, he was also, Timothy Leary felt that he was carrying on the work of Crowley. So at that time, you had the rise in drug use and sexual immorality and promiscuity, and all this stuff just started to happen right around the same time that Leary was preaching about Crowley's stuff, you know. And yeah, it flowed into the music world because Crowley taught how to communicate with spirits, really. And that's where a lot of these musicians get their songs from. Jimmy Page has even stated in interviews that he will sit in a room with candles lit and just sit there and hold his guitar and wait and wait and wait until all of a sudden his fingers just start to move. And an entire song will come to him while he's in that tranced out state. Now, these guys think that they're tapping into something special. They think that, you know, this is an amazing thing that I'm tapping into here. But really what's going on is they are being used by the spirit world to use music in a way to break down society, you know. What's interesting too, you know, and whether you believe in God or the Bible or not, or spirits or anything, it's irrelevant. The Bible, written thousands of years ago, mentions that Lucifer, the angel, when he was in heaven, before he got kicked out of heaven, when he was known as, you know, Lucifer the angel, he was gifted with music. That was his thing, eh? It says it in there, you know, that was his, he was gifted with the gift of music. And then he got kicked out for his envious ways of wanting to be like God, and now he uses people like Aleister Crowley to spread the word.
All right, well, Mr. Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca, let's take it from the 40s to the 50s, where, of course, rock and roll was condemned for being the devil's music, and the people who condemned it were probably right, because, of course, some of the devil or the devil incarnate, Aleister Crowley and the OTO, were behind that. Today, what do you think? Does the OTO still have any influence on modern music? Does the Aleister Crowley school of thinking affect us right now?
Absolutely. I wouldn't say the OTO has a direct influence on music to this day, but certainly Crowley's teachings do. And people still study his books. People still follow the philosophy of do what thou wilt. That's what the whole world is leading towards. That's essentially what spawned the New Age movement of, you know, if you believe do what thou wilt, well, the whole New Age movement is about that. It's all up to me. I have the power. You know, it's all up to what I do. So it certainly spawned that, and that's where we're heading. It's taking people away from God, essentially.
And do what thou wilt means do what you want. Does that mean do whatever you want? That means you're supposed to disregard morality in most of your decisions?
Basically, yes, right down to do whatever you want. LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan, when he wrote the Satanic Bible in 1969, he says he based the entire Satanic Bible on Crowley's Book of the Law. So it leads right into the Church of Satan, literally.
Very, very cool. Well, Mr. Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca, I know you work on music yourself. I know you're a fan of music yourself. What advice do you have for fans of music and artists out there to deal with this influence on music that's lasted for probably 100 years now?
You know, you have to be aware of the hidden hands behind what drives things. And you can just look at the industry, the music industry, in the last 10 years. I mean, when I started going to school for music about 10 years ago, there was something like 7 or 8 major record companies. Now, I believe there's something like 3 or 4. They're merging into smaller and smaller, fewer and fewer. So our choices of what we get to listen to, or rather, what we are told is popular, is in the hands of fewer and fewer people. So you just have to be aware of what these people are into, what their motives are, and when you're aware of where certain things come from, you know, you might start listening to different music. It sucks. Dave Grohl said it best when he says, you know what sucks? The devil writes the best tunes. And you know what? Because, you know, the sad fact is that that's kind of true, you know? So.
Well, you think that people out there can have different goals than what the music intends and still use the energy, the catchiness, or just the enjoyability factor of music to work on things that might be opposed to what the real or the planned ends of that music might be.
Sure. It's just you still have to beware because these spirits that work through musicians, they're cunning, they're tricky, they're deceiving. Nobody thinks that they're picking up anything. It's almost on a subconscious level. So yeah, you just have to be aware. I mean, I still like rock and roll. I still love listening to music, but at least I can see through some of the lyrics sometimes, and I see where it's coming from. That's what's important, really, is as long as people know that there's potentially a problem.
Well, you know what? It's been kind of hot, Mr. Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca, to say that, oh, music doesn't cause violence, video games don't cause violence, movies don't. You don't watch one and then suddenly shoot someone or anything like that. But it might be important to note, if you agree, that it isn't the changes that happen immediately. It is the changes that happen over time as this music is repeated throughout our culture and these images and ideas are given to us. Whether it's in your lifetime or over generations, it will have an effect on society.
That's right. And again, you look at these the musicians who really made it big in the 60s and 70s and whatnot, and then you look at who they're into, and you find out they all love Aleister Crowley. And then you start to look into what Crowley was all about, and what did he teach, what was his philosophy. And it's shocking when you get to the root of it, because it's satanic.
Can you recommend any good websites or movies for people to look into if they want to learn more about this subject?
I can think of one documentary. It's fantastic. It's called They Sold Their Soul for Rock and Roll. It is a long one. It's 10 hours long. I can't even remember. I believe it's at fightthegoodfight.com or Fight the Good Fight Ministries or something like that. But you could probably do a Google search for it. It's They Sold Their Soul for Rock and Roll. And that will really show you Crowley's influence on all this music that we're hearing now, which is destroying morale and society, essentially, you know, in very deceiving ways.
I feel you, Mr. Dan Dix from PressForTruth.ca. Thanks so much.
Cool, thank you.
2008. We're here at the event featuring Lieutenant Colonel Bob Bowman speaking about 9/11 and Professor Michael Greehy from Guelph speaking about the Toronto 18 case. And I'm here with Mr. Ali Mullah from the Canadian Arab Federation at CAF.ca. Mr. Mullah, what did you think of Dr. Bowman's presentation and or 9/11 issues in general?
Well, the 9/11 is still kind of mystery because, you know, if you follow the, we all follow the news and even the Congress report, the Special Commission report, left so many questions unanswered. However, you know, without concluding any result in advance, I think, you know, the whole issue has to be thoroughly investigated and the role of all the players. You know, I remember watching a documentary on TV, on CBC called The Power of Nightmare, which talk about, you know, the powerful gang around George Bush and Dick Cheney and how in the early 90s were plotting actually for the Iraq war and other things. So I don't know, you know, I'm not expert on those kind of international investigation, but, you know, if you follow the sequence of the events, and especially after everybody knows now, the war in Iraq was led on lies, or was led by lies, deception and greed. So you cannot escape the fact that you have to question the official theory about 9/11.
9/11 was 7 years ago, Mr. Mullah. Why do you think it's still relevant to us today as Canadians or as members of different ethnic groups within Canada and so on?
Well, you know, it opened a new era of the new empire of the world, and it had severe consequences on human rights and civil liberties, not only in regard to Arabs and Muslims, but also to ordinary Canadian and American as well. We know what's happening in the United States, where the president threatened to veto the Congress if they don't pass his last week resolution regarding investigation and spying on internet, phone, etc. So we were supposed to be living in a free democratic society, but unfortunately our freedom is slipping away very fast from us. And in the United States, in Canada, and in England, and in other parts of the world, there are so many people are being imprisoned, tortured, without proper charges. Never, some of them never been charged. And here in Canada, we have similar cases, and you know, people still before the court. If remind the listeners, you know, the case of the Toronto 18th. But before that, if we go back to the issue of the threadbare, where about 21 Pakistani youth were hustled by the RCMP and by the police, and they were led by a phony college who actually misled them to come to this country, and they paid the fee, they came legally, and you know, they followed the immigration rules, and when they got here, the college happened to be phony. Mind you, the college and its administrative were never charged, but those poor 21 were charged, and they were arrested, detained, and none of them being charged of anything, and you know, they damaged their life forever. So I think it is relevant because still so many questions have not been answered yet.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Ali Mullah from the Canadian Arab Federation at CAF.ca, what do you, well, you obviously can speak on this, what is the Canadian Muslim feeling about 9/11, the war on terror, and these related issues? And I'm saying that because we should be hearing it if we are trying to make peace, if we are trying to win the hearts and minds of the Arab Muslim community. We should be hearing more voices from them, but mysteriously in our media, we are not. So we don't actually hear what Canadian Muslims, Arabs have to say about this. What are your thoughts on the feelings?
Well, you know, it's not a secret that we have, unfortunately, very biased and stereotyped media, which, you know, cast the Muslim population as outsiders. And just recently, like a few weeks ago, there was a wonderful book launched by Professor Shireen Razzaq, and the title is Casting Out, The Eviction of Muslims from Law and Society in Western Democracies. And, you know, the majority of the Muslim people feel the pain and the pinch of what happened after September 11th, but because they are marginalized, they are oppressed, and they are actually living in fear. And there is a great element of self-isolation. Even, you know, don't speak up because they are worried. And, you know, with this so-called anti-terrorist law, security certificate, et cetera, people don't feel safe. And you know, but on the other hand, a lot of Muslims, you know, question the fact and say, we never worked with Bin Laden, but George Bush did. The American administration did work with Al-Qaeda. The Western democracy in Europe did work with Al-Qaeda and supported them, even Canada. All those Mujahideen of Al-Qaeda and Taliban were the shining star of Western democracy, but 99% of Muslims did not work with them, and here we are, the majority of the Muslim population paying the price of the misdeed of the Western democracy, quote-unquote.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Ali Mullah from the Canadian Arab Federation at CAF.ca, I want to ask you what you think the solutions to this are. It strikes me as possible that we cannot begin to even think about them unless we talk about these issues. So should we discuss these more? Should we discuss these without fear? Do you think it's wise to do it now? Do you think it'll be more difficult later? Break down the situation for those out there who are unaware of, A, the Canadian Muslim perspective on these issues, and B, the general Canadian perspective on these issues and how that should be considered by all of us.
Well, definitely, I believe as a responsible society, I think we have to continue asking the question and we have to continue challenging the system. Keep in mind that all those kind of so-called Patriot Act or terrorism laws or security certificate, even though it was done without proper discussion in the parliament, but they are enacted as a law by the government of the day. But if we go back several decades ago, also it was law in North America to have a slavery. Also it was law where women were not allowed to be vote and where they considered part of the property of a man. So it doesn't mean because it's a law, it's, you know, sacred and all have to follow. So I think we have a responsibility in this society because we value freedom of speech, we value human rights, and we value the social solidarity and standing up for justice and speaking up against injustice and tyranny. I think we have to stick together and keep raising our voices and exercise our rights, and you know, which include dissent and protest. I do, as a free man, have the right to dissent from the official theory of the government of the day, whether in Canada or the US or in Europe. And I hope majority of people will one day realize that, and we have to take back the agenda. Ordinary people are not included in the agenda of those governments. It's all catered toward big business and corporations.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Mullah, I've heard other people from different religious groups, including Christians, talk about why they need to reject government tyranny and, in some cases, the official 9/11 story, or look for lies or understand how corrupt power is. Is there any evidence in Islam for reasons why Muslims or others who subscribe to Islam or are familiar with Islam or respect Islam should use some of those philosophical ideas to challenge the government tyranny, the official story of 9/11, just so that people can get an idea that there is an argument to be made within Islam itself that would lead people to question the official events of this obvious lie, which has been exposed 7 years later?
Well, you know, I think it's very remarkable that we are having this forum or this event at the United Church on Bloor, which is one of the oldest churches in the city of Toronto. And as a Muslim, I truly believe that when it comes to spirituality and good deeds, there is no differential between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And to me, Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, and Moses, peace be upon him, and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, all of those were revolutionary men. They were not puppets of the rulers of their day. As a matter of fact, they were the defenders and the protector of the little guys, and they stood up for the little guys. So in Islam, of course, despite all the right-wing media and all those conspiracy about civilization, clash of civilization, and you know, this climate of fear from Muslim and against Muslim, there is nothing in Islam calls on people to just kill for killing, which is totally rejected, because Islam means peace.
Absolutely. Okay, final question, Mr. Mullah from CAF.ca, the Canadian Arab Federation. What is your advice out there for Canadians who may not know the perspective you're speaking on because it's not widely shared through our media? What is your advice to them about, A, how you feel, or B, how they should react to the propaganda that they are receiving?
Well, if I'm in a position to give any advice, I will advise myself first, and what I'm doing is, you know, I don't just trust what has been told, whether by the corporate media or by the government. As a people with conscience, we have to question. We have to question what goes on around us and what is being told to us. And therefore, you know, I would ask people not to shut the debate. You agree or disagree, just engage in the debate. If you have interested in the debate, walk away from it, but just don't dismiss it. Because the most disservice we can do to any truth is by shutting the debate.
Absolutely, and we are not debating to advocate for a certain position. We are debating so between the two of us in the dialectic, we can find the truth.
That's what we need to do. You know,
absolutely.
Let's engage in finding the truth.
Fantastic. Mr. Ali, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. It's
not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How can I try to explain? 'Cause when I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
A U.S. military judge dismissed the argument Friday that Guantanamo's youngest prisoner, Omar Khadr, was a child soldier when captured in Afghanistan and therefore in need of protection and not prosecution. U.S. Army Colonel Peter Brownback's ruling clears the way for Omar Khadr's trial, which will be the first war crimes trial in history of anyone under the age of 18. The Toronto-born 21-year-old now was 15 when he was shot and captured after a fight with U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan. He was first detained at Bagram Air Base, then transferred to Guantanamo. The Pentagon charged Khadr with five war crimes, including murder for the death of a U.S. soldier who was fatally wounded by a hand grenade. Khadr is scheduled to appear for a pretrial hearing in Guantanamo next week. Michelle Shepard is the national security reporter for the Toronto Star. She's been following Khadr's story since his arrest in 2002. Her new book traces the story of Omar Khadr's life. It's called Guantanamo's Child, The Untold Story of Omar Khadr. She joins us now from Toronto. She is now doing her first U.S. broadcast interview on this book. Thanks very much for joining us, Michelle. Tell us who Omar Khadr is.
Omar Khadr is the second youngest son of an Egyptian-Canadian named Ahmed Syed Khadr, who came to Canada, studied here, and during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, went as a charity worker. after the Soviets were defeated, he stayed on and continued his work, eventually aligning himself with many of al-Qaeda's elite. Omar and his siblings grew up between Canada, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, shuttled back and forth. And when, as you mentioned, when he was 15, after 9/11, his family had fled, and he was caught in a firefight with U.S. Special Forces. He was shot and captured, and he has been detained since. He's 21 now.
How did you end up getting involved with Omar Khadr?
I've been following the story since his capture, and I always found it an incredible story. His upbringing itself is like, you can't compare it to anything. But what struck me most about his case was his age. The fact that he was 15 when he was captured, and that his age had not been taken into consideration. And that's, for me, what separates his case from the others at Guantanamo. So I'd been following the case for the newspaper for almost 6 years now, and I just felt there I couldn't get the whole story in, so I decided to write a book on it.
Talk about what you know happened to Omar Khadr at the age of 15 when he was picked up.
Well, unfortunately, we don't know a lot yet. There's many conflicting reports. I interviewed many of the soldiers who were involved that day, and what they've told me is that they received a call from Washington that there had been a satellite phone used that had been picked up by NSA, and that it pinpointed a location in Afghanistan that they were sent to. When they went there, there were five men inside a compound, or what they believed were to be five men. When they asked the occupants to come out, they shot two of the Afghan soldiers that were with them, and a massive firefight followed, which included air support. At the end of this lengthy firefight, they believed all the occupants were dead inside the compound, and they went in to check the remains. At some point, and there's a sort of crucial 90 seconds that are going to be analyzed if we get to court on this case. At some point during that time, a grenade was thrown that fatally wounded Delta Force soldier Christopher Speer. And the Pentagon alleges that it was Omar who threw that grenade. For 5 years, his culpability was really not in doubt, because the Pentagon had believed he was the only remaining survivor. What we found out this February in a document that was mistakenly disclosed to us when we were at Guantanamo Bay was that there was actually another occupant of that compound that was alive at the time. And the document that we had was written by one of the Delta Force soldiers who was there, although he's not identified in the document. He alleges that after the grenade was thrown, he shot one of the occupants in the head and the chest, killing him. And then he shot Omar twice in the back. So at this point, we're not sure if he was the one to actually throw the grenade.
Your first chapter, Michelle Shepherd, is called Shoot Me. Why?
At the end of the battle, after Omar had been shot, and there's a picture in the book that I think is very telling. It shows the wounds he had, and there's these two. Gaping holes in his chest, which are actually the exit wounds of the bullets. One of the soldiers who was sent to guard him at that point to make sure he didn't escape, although when you look at this picture, you realize he wouldn't be able to. He said that Omar looked at him and said, "Shoot me."
I'm showing now for our TV viewers the image in the book of Omar, the very graphic bullet holes you see in his chest. For our radio listeners, you can go on our website, democracynow.org. We're talking to Michelle Shepherd. The book is called Guantanamo's Child. So he ends up at Guantanamo. Talk about his treatment, what you can reconstruct of it, what you know of it, what his family knows. Has his family seen him at all at this point?
Well, unfortunately, we can't talk to Omar. The Pentagon has a policy that they won't allow detainees to be interviewed. So his treatment I've cobbled together from some of the sources that you mentioned, some of the statements that he's told his lawyers, and interviews that I had with detainees who were kept with him. Both in Bagram and in Guantanamo, the detainees that had been in prison with him said that he was treated worse than some of the other prisoners who were brought in at the time. time, partly because he was injured, and he was interrogated right after he was brought in Bagram, whereas when his injuries were quite severe. So that in itself was seen as harsh treatment. He alleges through his lawyers that he was denied medication at this time as well. But I think overall it was the perception that, and the allegations that he had killed a soldier. And for the guards there, they treated him especially harsh because of that. The other prisoners at Bagram and at Guantanamo had been accused of connections with Al-Qaeda, but none had been accused of actually killing a soldier. And from what the other detainees told me, this dogged him for the first couple years anyway. And he was often shouted killer, murderer, butcher, and the guards were especially rough with him.
Can you talk about, and I'm showing the image again, of the older brothers of Omar Khadr. These brothers are, one you say worked for the CIA and was freed, another was extradited.
That's right. His eldest brother, Abdullah, is facing an indictment in a Boston court for terrorism. He is alleged to have purchased weapons for Al-Qaeda. Now, he's actually fighting his extradition, so he's been in a Toronto jail now for 2 years. But what's interesting to note in his case is that he's been charged in a domestic court, while Omar is classified as an enemy combatant and facing a war crimes trial. Abdullah, who had been picked up by Pakistani forces, brought back to Canada and then arrested in Canada on the warrant from the U.S., is actually facing a domestic charge. So he's in a Toronto jail. He's fighting his extradition, and he actually has a hearing this week as well, a bail hearing. His other brother, Abdurrahman, is the self-described black sheep of the family. And he had always rebelled against his father. His father had tried to send him to training camps. He often ran away. He was quite notorious for his behavior in Pakistan and Afghanistan. After 9/11, when the family fled, he returned to Kabul, and he was picked up very shortly after 9/11 by the Northern Alliance forces and eventually handed over to the U.S. When he was in Kabul, he was approached by FBI and eventually the CIA, and they asked him to become informant and an agent, which he did. He was later sent to Guantanamo, where they wanted him to spy on the other prisoners, but he didn't last very long there. At one point, he was able to shout to his brother Omar, but they never saw each other there. And I think he was identified pretty quickly in Guantanamo as a mole. So they got him out of there. They sent him to Bosnia. His story is quite incredible. It goes on at length, but just to wrap it up, they sent him to Bosnia. He blew his cover. He came back to Canada and eventually told Canadians his story, and included in telling his story were the details about his father's connection to Al-Qaeda members. He actually said, "We were an Al-Qaeda family." And that made many Canadians dub the Khadr family Canada's first family of terrorism.
Michelle Shepherd, can you talk about the international treaties around child soldiers, around children?
Well, what Omar's lawyers argued was that the international treaties, in particular, Convention of the Rights of the Child and the Optional Protocol, prohibit the prosecution of a minor. That they don't explicitly state that a prosecution can't occur, but in the language of the treaties, it protects those under the age of 18 who are captured in armed conflict. In their motion, they had many friends of the court offer submissions as well, many civil and human rights groups, and people such as David Crane, who is the former U.S. prosecutor for war crimes in Sierra Leone. And Crane said that I had the ability, the power, to try those under the age of 18, but I didn't do that. This was all before the military judge. And what the Pentagon argued was that while there hadn't been, in modern day history, a war crimes trial of someone under the age of 18, international law didn't prohibit it. Ultimately, the Guantanamo judge, as you mentioned, Peter Brownback, agreed with that and cleared the way for his trial.
And Michelle Shepherd, finally, you're talking to us from Canada, the attitude today of the detention, of the imprisonment of Omar Khadr at Guantanamo for what, over almost 6 years now, 15 years old when he was picked up?
Well, Amy, it's interesting because Canada finds itself in this very unique position as the only Western nation now to stand beside the Bush administration in support of Guantanamo and its trials. Omar is the only Western citizen that remains there. And over the past 2 weeks, there's been a lot of pressure on Ottawa to intervene in the case. The opposition groups, legal groups, civil human rights groups, and many international groups are demanding to know why Canada supports these trials where they've been condemned elsewhere. At this point, the Conservative minority government here in Canada has said they won't interfere in the process. And I think that has much to do with the reputation of Omar's family here in Canada. They've never been well-liked. They've said atrocious things in public. And I think that's overridden any concerns at this point for Omar himself.
Michelle Shepherd, thank you very much for being with us, national security reporter for the Toronto Star. Her book just out is called Guantanamo's Child, The Untold Story of Omar Khadr.
About to wrap up the show, you just heard an interview done with Amy Goodman and Michelle Shepherd on Democracy Now! Was done in May of this year, 2008. That is Michelle Shepherd from the Toronto Star, covering the Omar Khadr story. As I had promised last show that we would be looking at this issue, unfortunately due to the fact that I'm strained for time, and also due to the fact that some of the research that I've been doing, I don't have the time at the moment to give justice to the things about the story that are so significant that I would like to go into. So in the next show, you will hear me reading from articles from the research that I've uncovered about this story. I guess I'd have to say that probably like a lot of Canadians, I've been pretty ignorant about this particular story. I knew that Omar Khadr was a Canadian teenager caught up in the war on terror and living in Guantanamo, and that's about the extent of what I knew. I knew that Guantanamo was a bad place, but it wasn't up until a few months ago that I started looking into what was actually happening in Guantanamo with these allegations of torture that came up, and then to really fully look into what types of torture was being conducted there, not just the waterboarding, which is bad enough, but the sensory deprivation. We all know about the stories of Abu Ghraib. A lot of us want to tune out and think that it doesn't happen. Well, it does. And I went through an article that I was contemplating reading through on this show, but perhaps in the next show. And it's an article that's posted up on Toronto Change right now that I'm for you to take a look at. And it's called The Unending Torture of Omar Khadr. It was published a while back in the Rolling Stone, of all places. But if you want to take a look at that, it's real eye-openers to very well written. But it's a real eye-opener as to what type of treatment was given to Omar Khadr. And what you heard in the Democracy Now! Interview is the fact that what I think is what I consider to be very important about this story, Canada won't intervene in having Omar repatriated. And in October in 2008, he's going to be facing a military court under war crimes. It's important to look at the fact that at the time that Omar was injured and captured, he was only 15. It's also interesting to see that in the firefight that he was caught in the middle of, him and his companions had basically been cornered by enforcers. The compound that they were living in was first raided by an airstrike, and then their home was gunned down with machine gun. Every inhabitant except Omar and another was shot and killed. They stormed the shelter. and a grenade was thrown and an American soldier was killed, and two people were shot. One man died, and another was Omar Khadr, who was then taken to Bagram and then Guantanamo to endure torture and interrogation for the next 6 years. Two movies that I've watched recently that really opened my eyes to what the situation has been in Afghanistan is to watch The Oil Factor and Taxi to the Dark Side, which you can find both on Toronto Change, posted in the updates section. So I said I was going to wrap up the show, and I'm going to do so only because today is the day of the rally to bring Omar Khadr back to Canada, and I'll be there in a few hours to bring back footage for the event for the next show. But I will end the show on these 2 points. We basically recapped what is particularly interesting about the Omar Khadr story. A, that he is the a child, a young man, a teenager at the time of his capture, was subjected to 6 years in prison without trial, without intervention from Canada in terms of trying to bring him back to Canada, face Canadian justice system. And in 2008, he's going to be tried for war crimes. Now, how ironic is that? The first child in over 100 years to be tried for war crimes. And just think about all the war crimes that could be put up against people like George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, men like these who have so much blood on their hands and have violated so many crimes against humanity and violated so many international laws, will be the ones executing judgment against this boy. And that's what's so significant, is just the level of injustice and the level of hypocrisy that we as a society tolerate. And I'm not going to get into a huge rant about it right now, but just think about that. Just think about that. And I'm going to read the announcement that was pulled from the Toronto Coalition Against the War, nowar.ca, who are responsible for holding this event. It says, "Tell Stephen Harper to bring Omar Khadr back to Canada. Canadian citizen Omar Khadr is the only Western national left in Guantanamo Bay and the first child soldier to be prosecuted in more than 100 years. Khadr was only 15 years old when he was captured by U.S. forces in Afghanistan, later to be transferred to the infamous U.S. prison where he now spent more than a quarter of his life. Khadr faces a trial by U.S. military tribunal in October 2008. Recently released footage reveals that this kind of mistreatment that Khadr has experienced in Guantanamo Bay, where the U.S. is accused of practicing torture on detainees. Other reports show that Khadr was subjected to extreme forms of sleep deprivation, a form of torture, including the practice called the quote-unquote frequent flyer program, in which he was woken every 3 hours and moved to a different cell for 24 hours a day over a three-week period. Worse still, court documents reveal that Canadian government was aware of the abuse suffered by Khadr at the hands of U.S. authorities, yet continued to assure the Canadian public that he was being well-treated. And the fact that Omar Khadr is still being held in Guantanamo Bay is a national disgrace and an international embarrassment for all Canadians. Despite the growing evidence of Khadr's mistreatment, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has shamefully refused to bring Khadr back to Canada. Instead, Harper has said that he supports the U.S. military trial for Khadr and will not seek his release from Guantanamo Bay. Join us on July 26th to tell Stephen Harper to bring Omar Khadr back to Canada. Demonstrate your opposition to our government's decision to abandon a Canadian citizen in Guantanamo Bay and show your support for civil liberties and international law." Now, before I go, there's one other story that I think gives pretty good context to what we're looking at. Remember that in October, it is a young boy who is facing war crimes for fighting in self-defense, wounded in combat. He was only 15 at the time, held in Guantanamo, a prison, for 6 years, subjected to torture, beatings, long interrogations, sensory deprivation, and all kinds of cruel psychological punishment. and the title of this article is "For His Treatment of Children in the War on Terror, Bush is a War Criminal," written by Dave Lindorf. "For His Treatment of Children in the War on Terror, Bush is a War Criminal." Surely nothing that President Bush has done in his two wretched terms of office, not the invasion and destruction of Iraq, not the overturning of 5 centuries-old tradition of habeas corpus, not his authorization and encouragement of torture, not his campaign of domestic spying, nothing can compare in its ugliness as his approval as commander-in-chief of the imprisoning of over 2,500 children. According to the U.S. government's own figures, that is how many kids, 17 years and younger, have been held since 2001 as enemy combatants for over a year and sometimes for over 5 years. At least 8 of those children, some reportedly as young as 10, were held at Guantanamo. They even had a special camp for them there, Camp Iguana. One of the kids committed suicide at the age of 21 after spending 5 years in confinement at Guantanamo. Ironically and tragically, that particular victim of the president's criminal policy had been determined by the Pentagon to have been innocent only 2 weeks before he took his own life, but nobody bothered to tell him that he was slated for release and a return home to Afghanistan. I say Bush's behavior is criminal because, since 1949, under the Geneva Convention, signed and adopted by the U.S. and incorporated into U.S. law under the Constitution's Supremacy Clause, children under the age of 15 are classified as protected persons, and even if captured while fighting against U.S. forces, are to be considered victims, not prisoners of war. In 2002, the Bush administration signed an updated version of that treaty, raising the protected person age to all those under 18. Treaties don't mean much to this president, to the vice president, or to the rest of the administration, but they should mean something to the rest of us. But capturing and imprisoning children isn't even the worst of this president's war crimes when it comes to the abuse of the young. Under Bush's leadership as commander-in-chief, the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan has been considering any male child in Iraq of age 14 or older to be a potential combatant. They have been treated accordingly, shot by U.S. troops, imprisoned as enemy combatants, and subjected to torture. In 2004, assault by U.S. Marines on the city of Fallujah, things were even worse. Dexter Filkins, a reporter of the New York Times, reported that before the invasion, some 20,000 Marines encircled the doomed city, which the White House had decided to level because it harbored a bunch of insurgents and had angered the American public by capturing, killing, and mutilating the bodies of 4 mercenaries working under U.S. forces. The residents of the 300,000 population city were warned of the coming all-out attack. Women, children, and old people were allowed to flee the city and pass through the cordon of troops. But Filkins reported that males determined to be of combat age, which in this case was established 12 and up, were barred from leaving and sent back into the city to await their fate. Young boys were ripped from their screaming mothers and sent trudging back to the city to face death. In the ensuing slaughter, the U.S. dumped bombs, napalm, phosphorus, antipersonal fragmentation weapons, and an unimaginable quantity of machine gun and small arms fire on the city. It is clear that many of those young boys died. This was a triple war crime. First of all, it was the case of collective punishment, a practice popular with the Nazis in World War II, and barred by Geneva Conventions. The international laws of war also guaranteed the right of surrender, so those men and boys who tried to leave, even if suspected of being enemy fighters, should have been allowed to surrender and held as captives until their loyalties could be established. The boys, meanwhile, were protected persons who were by law to be treated as victims of war and to be protected from harm. Instead, they were treated as the enemy to be destroyed. For these crimes, the president should today be impeached by the Congress and then tried as a war criminal. After watching this Congress cower from its responsibility to defend the Constitution, I have little hope of that happening. But I do harbor the hope that once Bush has left office, some prosecutor in another country, perhaps Spain or Canada, no, that won't happen, or Germany, will use the doctrine of universal jurisdiction to indict him for war crimes, and should he leave the country for some lucrative speaking engagement, arrest him the way former dictator Augusto Pinochet was arrested by Spanish prosecutor on a visit to the UK. For his abuse, imprisonment, and killing of children, this president should stand for trial of war crimes. And Dave Lindorf's most recent book is The Case for Impeachment. His work is available at www.thiscan'tbehappening.net. So that is something to consider when looking into, if you choose to look into the story of Ahmaud Carter. What you'll find out there in the media is a lot of opinion. I found it's 50-50 between for and against should Omar be brought back to Canada to face some sort of justice in Canadian courts as opposed to U.S. military courts. But our media has once again completely missed the point that we are working with a war criminal president, George W. Bush. The people of Afghanistan, the people of Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, that's admitted, yet the war rages on, which really highlights the fact that the people of the Middle East, the Iraqis and the Afghans, have suffered the most in this war on terror, and we need to own up to the hypocrisy. If you'd like to begin to look into this information, do check out the writings of Michelle Shepherd on the star.ca. Check out the article on Toronto Change, The Unending Torture of Omar Carter in the articles section. And then click on updates, go to the featured films, and please watch the Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror, as well as Taxi to the Dark Side, to give you a good perspective on what is happening in Iraq, Afghanistan, and what is happening in Guantanamo Bay. This has been a broadcast from Toronto Change. I'm your host, Darcy. Thanks again. We'll be right back.